far side of the room near the elevators. The elevators. I couldn't go back in the stairwell. They'd be looking for me there. But the elevators, they were my ticket out of here. But they were all the way across the room, and I didn't exactly look like I worked here. The man and the woman were both wearing business suits. I was wearing jeans, sneakers, and one of my t-shirts that they'd brought to me from home when my stay as a guest became more like semi-permanent resident. I didn't look like a government agent. I looked more like the pizza delivery boy. Delivery boy? I peeked around the cubicle door at the mail cart parked by the stairs. I might not look like I belonged in a cubicle, but maybe I would pass for a mailroom delivery guy. Unless the mailroom delivery guys in secret U.S. government facilities wore suits too, or were soldiers or something, but it was worth a shot. I certainly couldn't go back the way I came. The mail cart was like a two-decker shopping cart with a handle on one end and wire baskets on top and bottom. The top was filled with file folders with names on the labels. People who worked on this floor, I guessed. The folders were all empty. Somebody had already delivered all the mail. That was good. I wasn't going to be doing any real delivering. The bottom part of the cart had a bunch of brown 9x12 envelopes in it, each one with three columns of spaces on each side where you could write in the name of the person inside the building you wanted the envelope to go to. Inner office mail. These were empty, too. An ID badge hanging off the top basket had a picture of a guy named Chad Dill, position, mail clerk, on it. He didn't look a thing like me. What the heck? I buried my gun in the pile of envelopes, took a deep breath, picked out the elevators across the room, and started pushing. Chapter 37. I wanted to sprint, wanted to run with the cart like I used to do in the parking lot of the grocery store, hop on and zoom past all these cubicles. But I had to be cool. I had to walk slow enough so that when people saw me pass their cubicles, they would barely even look at me. If any of these people were working on Darius's case, if any of them recognized me, it was all over. The mail cart wheels squeaked so loud I jumped. I tried it again, going easier this time, but it still squeaked loudly in the quiet office. It was like a bullhorn announcing my presence. Here I am, Cameron Smith, escaped fugitive. Come and get me. But there was nothing else to do. The mail cart was my costume. My disguise. I needed people to see it, not me. Well, one thing was for sure. They were going to hear it. I squeaked past the dog-obsessed lady, but she didn't even look up. I didn't know if she couldn't hear me with her headphones on, or if she was so used to the squeaky mail cart by now that she just ignored it. I pushed on, squeaking the whole way. The elevators looked impossibly far away. Another woman came out of the cubicle right beside me, scaring me to death. I froze, and she squeezed on by without a second look. I breathed again. Okay, test number one complete. I looked like the mail guy. Maybe not Chad Dill, but some mail guy. That's all that mattered. It was time to get moving again. That alarm might sound any second now, and then I wouldn't be overlooked. I pushed on, a little faster this time, threading my way through the cubicles. At first, I kept my head down, but when it looked like nobody even cared that I was there, I started peeking into the cubicles, watching people as I passed. It was night. At least, I thought it was night, but there were still a lot of people at work. Maybe they worked in shifts, like a factory. The intelligence factory. At the intelligence factory, your secrets are our business. I couldn't tell what people were doing exactly, besides typing on computers, watching videos, and reading newspapers in foreign languages. It all looked pretty boring. Nothing like Q's secret gadget lab and James Bond. Where were the exploding pens and electromagnet watches?
Hey there, hold on, a man called.
I put my head down and kept pushing, hoping he wasn't talking to me.
Hey, I said hold up,
the man said, closer now. A hand grabbed my shoulder and spun me around. I was busted. Chapter 38. I froze. I was more than halfway to the elevators, but too far away to run for it. My eyes went immediately to the pile of envelopes in the bottom basket where my gun was hidden.
Sorry, the man said, letting me go.
He came around in front of me, blocking my way. He was average height, youngish, white, with brown hair and a receding jaw. He wore gray pants, a white long-sleeved shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and a red tie. He smiled.
You must not have heard me. Got your earbuds in?
He still thought I was the mail clerk.
What?
No, sorry, I said, trying to cover my unease. I was just... my mind was somewhere else.
Yeah, he said. Totally get that. These late-night shifts, man. I didn't think they ran mail overnight.
I didn't know what to say to that, so I shrugged. Luckily, the guy didn't seem to really care. He was just making small talk.
You got any of those inter-office envelopes?
He asked. He scanned my cart, spying the stack of them in the bottom basket. The stack hiding my pistol.
Here we go,
he said. He bent down to grab an envelope. I dropped down with him.
I'll get one for you.
I got it,
he said. He put his hand in and fished around. I glanced up at the top of the elevator across the room, calculating how fast I could get there.
Huh, what's this?
He said. Run, I told myself, just run. The guy held up an envelope.
Here's one with every line used up, he said. Never thought I'd see one, but I guess it has to happen sometime, right? Like Bigfoot sightings.
Yeah, I said. Sure, just please, please, please let me go.
Here, he said, giving me the envelope like there was some special ceremony for envelopes that had all the address lines used up.
Then he put his hand back in the basket looking for another envelope. Not again. I watched his hand, wishing it away from the gun I'd hidden in there. He grabbed an envelope, and I sighed with relief, until I saw the barrel of the gun sticking out from among the envelopes. The guy stayed where he was, stuffing a piece of paper he'd brought with him into the envelope. I stared at the barrel of the gun the entire time, waiting for him to see it while he was writing the recipient's name on the envelope. I had just decided to reach out and tug at one of the envelopes to cover the barrel when he finished and looked up at me.
There we go, he said, handing me the envelope. You're good to go.
Thanks, I said.
Let me know if you run into Bigfoot, too,
he said, and he disappeared back into his cubicle. I chucked the envelope he'd given me in the basket, covering the gun, and hustled for the elevators. I didn't care if anybody saw me moving fast. I wanted out of there. I got to the elevators without anybody else stopping to talk to me about Bigfoot, and I slapped the up button. The elevator dinged as it arrived on sublevel 14. Luckily, there was no one else inside. The other elevator arrived beside it with a ding, and I hurried into mine before whoever was getting out of the other one could see me. I mashed the ground floor button and punched the closed door button over and over again. The door slid closed just as another woman in a business suit walked past. I thought I saw her look inside, thought her eyes caught mine for a split second, but then the door was closed and the elevator was lifting me up to safety. For now. Chapter 39. I watched the red digital numbers on the elevator tick by slowly, excruciatingly slowly. Sublevel 13. Sublevel 12. Come on, come on, come on. This had to be the elevator I'd taken into the Department of Homeland Security building that first night, the one I could barely tell was moving. It was slower than watching a soccer game. The World Cup. Hagen had been so sure the target was the Women's World Cup, but it couldn't be. Not the real target, I was sure of it. Darius was still in danger. The United States was still in danger. And if they weren't going to do anything about it, I was. Sublevel 11. Sublevel 10. The elevator dinged and stopped. No, 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 no. The doors opened, and an Asian man in dark business slacks, a white dress shirt, and a dark tie got on, his ID badge glinting where it hung on his belt. I stared down at the mail cart, trying to be invisible as he punched the button for the floor he wanted. Did he know who I was? Did he know there was a prisoner on the loose in the building? If he recognized me, would he call security? Try to grab me and drag me back to my cell? My eyes went to the basket on the bottom of the cart. The gun was buried there. I wasn't going to shoot anyone. I already knew that. But you didn't have to shoot a gun to use it. Couldn't I just threaten him with it? Hold him off until we got to the top floor, and then make a run for it when the doors opened? I could be out the front door before he even called security.
How's it going?
The man asked. I jumped. He'd settled in beside me in the elevator, both of us facing the door, and we were already moving to sublevel 9. He looked at me. I was taking too long to answer. I had to do something, say something.
Good,
I said at last, my voice croaking. Smooth, Cameron, real smooth. Stare at the floor like a 5-year-old. Wait so long to respond to somebody saying hey that you draw attention to yourself, then sound as awkward and guilty as possible. James Bond, you're not.
Sorry, I said. Long day.
The guy nodded sympathetically.
Yeah, tell me about it.
And that was it. Enough, at least, to get him to stare at the elevator door again and forget all about me. Just be cool, Cameron, I told myself. You're the male guy. You look the part. Now act it. I'd never understood Julia's love of drama club and acting. It wasn't my thing. I mean, I went to all her plays and pretended to be interested, but before we dated, you couldn't have paid me to go see a play. Whenever they'd brought the whole school into the auditorium to watch whatever play the drama club was putting on that semester, I'd hunkered down in my seat and closed my eyes, grateful for the afternoon away from classes, but otherwise totally bored out of my mind. But now, suddenly, I had a real appreciation for what it took to get up on stage in front of other people and pretend to be someone you weren't. I was scared speechless. I wouldn't be surprised if my stinking, soaked armpits didn't give me away. Then, on sublevel 8, the elevator dinged and the doors opened again. Chapter 40. A white woman in a gray pantsuit got on, nodding to the other guy and me. She pushed a button. The elevator moved. I stared at my cart. The elevator dinged and stopped again. Seriously? It was nighttime. How many people were working late? Too many. A white guy in a suit got into the elevator, and I worked my way farther into the corner. At least now there were so many of us, no one felt forced to talk. You know how it is. If there's just two of you, it's awkward not to say something. If the elevator's full of people, you can just pretend you're all alone, even if you're squeezed in like a package of peeps. Safety in numbers, isn't that what they say? I was surrounded by people who might recognize me, might bust me any second, but in a weird way, having more people in the elevator made me more invisible. The first guy to get on the elevator with me got out at sublevel 3. Only 3 more floors to go. I took a deep breath and thought about what was going to come next. I'd wait for everybody else to get off the elevator on the ground floor, and then I'd follow them out. Ditch the mail cart around a corner somewhere, slip outside, make a run for it. I wouldn't be in Arizona, I was sure of that, but hopefully I could find a way back. Catch a ride with someone, beg money for a bus. I'd walk if I was close enough, but I couldn't worry about that now. Right now, I had to focus on just getting out the front door. The elevator dinged, and the little red numbers said we were on the ground floor at last. I played the part of the courteous mailroom guy holding the door open as the more important people left. That's when I saw the main floor beyond the elevator. Between me and the dark glass doors at the front of the building were perhaps a dozen people, most of them guards. Soldiers in black fatigues and helmets patrolled the lobby, automatic weapons in their hands. Video cameras hung in the corners. The only way into the building was past the guards working metal detectors and scanners, and the only way out was past another guard at a turnstile that only worked when you checked out with your ID card. This was no generic office building with an empty lobby and a single security guard watching basketball on his monitor. It was a heavily secured government facility, one I wasn't walking out of. Chapter 41. I pulled back into the elevator and slumped into the corner. What was I thinking? Where did I think I was? Who did I think I was? I was a prisoner in a U.S. government building. I was an idiot to think I could just run down the hall from my cell, bang open a door, and run off into the night. I was trapped. I had no way out. Maybe I should turn myself back in and beg for understanding. The doors began to close like the stage curtain closing at the end of a play, and I watched in despair as my only way out disappeared.
Hold the door,
a woman called. I shrank back, but she stuck her hand in, catching the doors before they closed. She was one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen. She was young and fluid and alive, even here in this cold, gray government building, especially here. She could have been on television. She had light brown Middle Eastern skin, dark hair and dark eyes and full lips. She was wearing a dark blue skirt and jacket over a form-fitting white shirt. If she'd passed me at the mall, I would have stared. But I wasn't at the mall. I was on the run in the elevator of a secure government facility. I dropped my eyes to the mail cart, still panicking, still trying desperately to think what to do.
Hello,
she said, turning her 1,000-watt smile on me. I was so flustered, I didn't even say hello back.
You missed the mailroom, she added.
I was usually cool around pretty girls at school, but this woman was so beautiful I could barely put two words together.
Huh? It's on sublevel 4, isn't it? Where the trucks come in?
She said.
What?
I said dumbly.
Sublevel 4, she said again. The mailroom. That's where the big trucks come in from outside.
Yeah, I said. Yeah, the mailroom. Trucks outside access, probably without all the scanners and cameras and metal detectors.
Yeah,
I said. She smiled at me again. I felt like my own personal guardian angel was pointing me the right way. My own gorgeous guardian angel.
Oh, silly me. I forgot to push my button, she said.
She leaned over and pushed the button for sublevel 12.
Want me to push 4 for you? She asked me.
Yeah, I said. Thanks. We stood next to each other, me trying to ignore how pretty she was and failing miserably, her probably already having long forgotten I existed. She hummed a song while we waited, and distantly I recognized it as that old NSYNC song, Bye Bye Bye. The elevator dinged and I started to move my cart toward the door, but this was just sublevel 3, one more floor to go. The doors opened and a white guy in a suit started to step inside.
Rick, the woman said, just the man I was coming to see.
She intercepted him, putting her arm in his and walking him back off the elevator. The doors closed on them, and I let out the breath I didn't know I'd been holding. I silently thanked my guardian angel and punched the sublevel 4 button again, even though it was already lit. I had a second chance. Maybe there was some way I could say bye 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 to this place after all. Chapter 42. I stepped off the elevator, pushed the mail cart through thick pieces of hanging plastic, and entered the building's mailroom. It was a huge facility with conveyor belts, wheeled canvas carts big enough to crawl inside, stacks of smaller plastic mail tubs, and huge sorting areas. At the back of the room were long concrete loading bays and garage doors where semis could back in. Miraculously, one of the bays was open. An unmarked trailer was parked backward in the stall, and the garage door at its head was wide open. I could see darkness outside, and freedom. I was giddy just thinking about how close I was. Just a little farther, and I would be outside and on my way to Darius. But first, I had to get past the dogs. There were two of them, German shepherds led around on leashes by two U.S. soldiers in black fatigues with automatic rifles over their shoulders. The rest of the mailroom was almost empty except for the two men in jumpsuits wheeling boxes off the truck on dollies. The soldiers walked in and out of the truck and around the boxes, their dogs sniffing everything. The truck I had to sneak past to get outside. One of the dogs raised its head and looked straight at me, and I hurriedly pushed my mail cart behind a sorting machine. I peeked out again, but the soldiers and mailroom guys hadn't seen me. The dogs knew I was there, but they were trained to sniff for explosives and toxins, I guessed, not to be watchdogs. But they'd be on to me the second I got anywhere close to that truck, and just when I was so close. I debated just leaving the gun where it was, but eventually I pulled it out from its hiding place under the envelopes. What was I carrying the thing around for if I wasn't going to shoot at anybody with it? I sighed, knowing I still couldn't do it. But I had to find some way around that truck. I watched the workers and the soldiers with the dogs, trying to look for some pattern to their movements, some opportunity for me to slip through.
But this was no video game with NPCs who marched around on set routines so you could sneak up behind them and knock them out. These were real people, real Americans with jobs and families and lives. I had to get away, but I couldn't hurt anybody doing it. There, on the wall, a fire extinguisher, right beside where the workers were stacking the boxes and the dogs were sniffing them. Adam and I had once watched a video on YouTube of some idiots shooting fire extinguishers. The red canisters erupted like geysers when they were shot, spraying a thick white cloud of carbon dioxide everywhere. Harmless, but really hard to see through the cloud. And they'd make a terrific distraction until these guys figured out what hit them. My hand trembled a little as I propped the gun on a conveyor belt that wasn't running. I took aim very carefully. The fire extinguisher seemed a lot farther across the room than when I'd first come up with the idea, but I was sure I could do it. I shot stuff at this distance all the time in video games. I just had to wait until the four men were close enough to the fire extinguisher to be swallowed up by the cloud, but not so close that I would hit one of them if I missed. I waited, watching them move back and forth, my heart pounding in my chest, and then I saw my chance. I squared up my aim and pulled the trigger. Chapter 43. Nothing happened. The trigger didn't budge. I pulled the gun back and stared at it. Why didn't it shoot? Wait, guns had safeties on them, didn't they? So you couldn't shoot yourself in the foot by accident when you were pulling your gun out of your holster. I searched the sides of the pistol, trying to figure out which of the switches and buttons was the safety. I felt way in over my head. I flicked a switch near my thumb to what I figured was shoot, or unsafe, maybe, and took aim again. I had to wait forever for everyone to be going the same direction again, but then at last, I had another chance. I squinted down the short barrel of the gun, held my breath, and squeezed the trigger. The gun kicked like a line drive taking a bad hop, and I ducked reflexively, my ears ringing like crazy. The bang was so loud. Then the air was filled with yelling and barking. I peeked out from behind the machine. The fire extinguisher was still there. I'd missed it, and now the soldiers and workers thought somebody was shooting at them. They'd all ducked behind boxes, the soldiers scanning the room with guns in hand. No, I'd ruined everything. I was going to be caught, thrown back in my cell, handcuffed. I had shot at United States soldiers. They would never believe me when I told them I was shooting for the fire extinguisher. The soldiers were yelling into walkie-talkies. In minutes, seconds, security would pour in through the hanging plastic, and I was done for. I had to make a run for it, but I couldn't, not without being seen. I aimed at the fire extinguisher again. They were all still huddled around it, but at least this time, they were hiding out of the way. I pulled the trigger, and the gun exploded again. Another miss. The soldiers ducked. I tried again, and again, and again. Nothing. Dang it. How hard was it to hit a fire extinguisher from across the room? The soldiers had figured out where I was from the gunshots. One of them was taking aim at me as I tried one last shot. Thoom! The fire extinguisher exploded, swallowing everything on that side of the room in a white cloud. Yes! I scrambled up from where I knelt, my arms sore and my whole body shaking. I sprinted along the side of the tractor trailer away from the yelling soldiers and barking dogs and into the cold night air. I was free. I'd made it outside. I couldn't stop running, though, not until I was far enough away from the building to hide someplace. I ran up a long, wide concrete ramp to a big, dark parking lot, slipping in the snow as I stopped to get my bearings. Snow? I shuddered in the freezing cold air. I'd forgotten it was mid-January, but this was definitely not Arizona, or Nevada, or New Mexico. Colorado, maybe? Up in the mountains? I couldn't stand around figuring it out. I ran in among the scattered cars in the parking lot and crouched down, trying to hide. I had to figure out which way to run before I really put my legs into it. I peeked up through the snow-covered car windows, and my eyes fell on a giant white obelisk in the distance with two blinking red lights on the top. Dully, I realized what I was looking at. It was the Washington Monument. The gun slipped from my hand and clattered to the ground as I stood and stared. I wasn't in Arizona or Nevada or California or Colorado. I was in Washington, D.C. Chapter 44. Washington, D.C. I knew things were serious, that this business with Darius was big time, but not this big time. Not fly Cameron Smith to Washington and detain him in the Department of Homeland Security headquarters kind of serious. I realized I was standing in plain sight and dropped back down between the cars. I couldn't see the Washington Monument anymore, almost like it had been a dream. But it hadn't been a dream. I was in Washington, D.C., something like 2,000 miles away from home. I heard shouts from the ramp down to the mailroom. I had to run. I would have to figure out how to get back home later. 2,000 miles? There were trees in the distance beyond the parking lot. I grabbed the gun out of the slush and hurried toward the trees, still crouching low. I came to the end of a Volvo, looked both ways for guards, and sprinted across the open road to the next line of cars. Safe. I was almost to the end of a big white SUV when I heard a shout behind me and turned to look. I couldn't see anything but cars, but that was a good thing. It meant they couldn't see me either. Just a few more rows, and then I would be to the woods. I turned to run again, and the burly African-American soldier who'd come to my cell to transfer me stood in my way. I knew it was the same guy because there was dried blood caked around his nose where I'd hit him, and he looked seriously unhappy about it. In a daze, I remembered I still had the gun and raised it, my arm moving like I was underwater. Then the gun wasn't in my hand anymore. It was in the soldier's hand. He'd taken it from me in the blink of an eye. Somebody hit the fast-forward button, and he punched me in the chest, knocked the wind out of me, spun me around, caught me before I sank to my knees, put me in a headlock, one arm around my neck, the other covering my gasping mouth. And just like that, it was all over. I was caught. Chapter 45. My sneakers cut paths through the slush in the parking lot as the big soldier dragged me backward, away from the Homeland Security building. A white van screeched up behind us, and its side door flung open. Hands grabbed me, dragged me inside, and the door slid shut with a bang.
"Go,"
the soldier said, his voice deep and urgent. The van accelerated. It was dark inside, windowless, and it took me as long to catch my breath as it did for my eyes to adjust. I was on the floor of an empty cargo van. There were two seats at the front, only one of them was occupied. The driver was a young white guy with sandy brown hair, wearing all black, but that's all I could make out from my angle. The big soldier sat on a low metal bench welded to the van wall behind me, his huge black army boots by my head. Another man, tall but thin, sat in shadow on a bench on the other side of the van, facing me.
"Well," the shadowy man said, his voice instantly familiar, "I have to say you certainly made that a lot harder than it had to be."
"Mr. Hagen?" I said. It was. A passing streetlight lit up the inside of the van, illuminating his thin, stubbly face. I sat up. "Mr. Hagen? But what? How? Why?"
"All very good questions," Hagen said. "Have a seat, and I'll try to answer them all. We don't have much time."
A phone rang, and Hagen pulled his out of his pocket and looked at the screen. He held up a finger.
"I need to take this," he said.
He answered it and held it to his ear.
"Hagen."
He waited.
"Escaped, you say?"
He feigned surprise and looked right at me.
"Now how did he do that?"
I climbed up onto the bench beside the soldier as Hagen listened, and I purposefully slid a few inches away. My chest still throbbed from the big guy's punch. I had been hit a lot in football games, but I'd never taken a shot as hard and painful as that man's fist.
"Did he now?" Hagen said. "Did he now? Incredible. And you think he had help?" "I see. Do you have a description of the vehicle?" "Yes, I see. Yes, of course. I was already headed in. I'm in the car as we speak. If I see the van, I'll do what I can to detain it. Yes. All right.
Hagen hung up and put the phone back in his pocket.
It seems you've managed a daring escape, Cameron Smith. Far more daring than the more prosaic one I had already arranged for you.
But you said... Hagen put up a hand. I always meant to break you out.
The moment the higher-ups told me we were finished, that they had their one and only terrorist plot all taken care of, thank you very much. Now get back to your cubicle, Mickey Hagen. I knew I had to do something. We had to do something. And that meant getting you away from there.
So you believe me, I said, about Darius being in Arizona. I felt a huge weight lift off my shoulders. I'd been so convinced I was alone. I'd been ready for it, ready to go it solo, to sacrifice everything to help my brother if I had to. But to know I had at least one ally, and a smart, connected one at that, was a huge relief. You believe me again, I said.
No, Hagen said. I never stopped believing. But I couldn't very well come into your cell and say, Cameron, I'm sending in a friend of mine with all the right papers to transfer you to another facility, but he's really breaking you out. You noted, of course, the camera in the corner.
I turned to look at the big soldier. Hagen had sent him to get me out, and I'd smacked him in the face with a metal tray.
The soldier didn't look at me. He was busy disassembling the gun I'd taken from him and that he had taken back so easily. They'd have heard me, seen me for sure if I tried to tell you, Hagen went on. I had to play it the other way, in fact. Convince you we were finished so as to allay suspicion when you did escape. I'd be suspect number one in helping you escape, you see, close as we were. So I came to you and played the part of the insecure intelligence agent, the role I was born to play. I don't mind playing the fool, but I hated to hurt you like that. I'm sorry, Cameron.
I shook my head. It didn't matter. All was forgiven. I was in a van, speeding away from the building where I'd been held, speeding toward Darius in Arizona.
So I went home to watch telly and sent Dane Redmanier in for you, Hagen said, nodding at the big guy. Dane's an old friend of mine. His speciality is getting people in and out of dangerous places. He's ex-Special Forces.
I knew what that meant. Special Forces soldiers were Green Berets, highly trained elite soldiers who specialized in unconventional warfare. You could drop a team of Green Berets behind enemy lines, and in a week, the 12 of them would walk out again with the warlord they'd been sent in after, without anybody else ever knowing they were there. They were the best of the best.
I was only after a routine snatch and grab, Hagen said. But you made it anything but routine.
The young sandy-haired driver laughed, a real delighted laugh like he enjoyed any kind of chaos.
First time I ever seen somebody get the drop on Dane, he said, cackling. Took his gun, too.
Cameron, meet Jimmy Doran. Jimmy's our tech guy, Hagen said. The driver waved. He's the one who looped the video in your room when Dane went in. He's also the person who unlocked that key-coded door for you in the stairwell.
You? I stammered.
Jimmy laughed again.
Wouldn't have had a clue where you were until the system registered all those wrong tries. Mashing all the buttons was a particularly nice touch, he said. I killed the alarm you should have triggered and unlocked the door for you.
Dane ejected the bullet clip from the butt of his gun and frowned at it.
There's 6 bullets missing, he said.
He turned his hard eyes on me.
You shoot somebody?
No, I said.
The only thing Cameron killed was one very stubborn fire extinguisher, Hagen said with a grin.
Saw that on the security camera feed, Jimmy said from the front seat. Nice trick. I was about to kill the lights for you, but you did all right on your own.
It took you 6 shots to hit one fire extinguisher?
Dane said. I've never shot a gun before, all right? I said.
Oh, hang on, guys, Jimmy said. I gotta pick up this hitchhiker. She's a real looker.
What? I looked at Hagen, trying to understand. We couldn't stop for hitchhikers.
Hagen's eyes told me to wait. The van slid to a stop, and the gorgeous woman from the elevator climbed into the passenger seat. Chapter 46. Jimmy floored it again, and the beautiful woman turned and waved at me. Even here in the van, just the flash of her smile made me blush.
Aliya Saeed, counterterrorism expert and CIA consulate, Hagen said. I had her in the building just in case. Good thing, too. When you went rogue, we had to steer you to the mailroom, and Aliya was gracious enough to drop the hint.
The late-night transfer, the key code in the stairwell, the hint in the elevator, my entire escape had been watched over, orchestrated even, by these three guardian angels. For all I knew, Dane had sent security on a wild goose chase after they found him, buying me more time. I never would have gotten out without their help. And here I thought I'd been so clever, so smart. I was an idiot. Without their help, I would have been caught a dozen times over. Hagen seemed to read my mind. He laughed.
Cameron, did you ever happen to hear the story about the man who asked God to help him escape from a flood?
You mean like Noah?
No, not that flood. A wee bit smaller one. It goes something like this. There's a flood, see, and the waters, they chase the man in our story up onto his roof. The rain keeps falling and the waters keep rising, but our man's not worried. That's because he's sure his God is going to save him. Well, in short order, a rowboat comes along, and a man rowing it tells our man on the roof to jump in. No thanks, says he. I'm waiting on God to save me. And a man in the rowboat goes along his way. Well, the waters rise, getting ever closer, and along comes a motorboat. But our man's response is the same. Go save someone else, he says. God will save me. So off goes the motorboat, and the waters, they come up to our man's feet. Last of all comes a helicopter, and they drop our man a ladder. But what does he tell them?
God will save me, I said.
Hagen nodded. He sends the helicopter packing and settles in, waiting for God to save him. Well, the rain keeps falling and the water keeps rising, and our man, he swept away and drowns. Being a pious lad, he goes straight to heaven, but when he gets there, he's got a bone to pick with his maker. I had faith in you, he tells God. I prayed to you, believed in you. You said you would save me, but you never did. What's up with that? God shrugs. I sent you a rowboat, a motorboat, and a helicopter, says he. What more do you want?
Dane snorted a laugh.
You, Hagen said to me, you're like our man on the roof. Only you jumped in and tried to swim before I could even send you a rowboat.
So if Dane's the rowboat, and I'm the motorboat, and Aliyah's the helicopter, Jimmy said, what's that make you in this story, Mickey? God?
Hagen grinned. How close are we? He asked Jimmy.
5 minutes.
You got all these people together just to break me out? I asked. I was feeling a little unworthy.
Not just to get you out, Hagen said. To go with you to Arizona to find your brother and stop a terrorist attack.
Chapter 47. My pulse quickened. So I really was going to do it. We were going to do it. My escape had been worth it after all.
Don't think it will be easy, Hagen warned me. These three are good, the best. But you'll still have work to do to find your brother, and the authorities will be after you at every turn. And then there's Haidar Ansari.
Ansari, the Iraqi terrorist Hagen had told me they thought was behind everything. He hadn't been captured with the Al-Qaeda cell planning to blow up the Women's World Cup. Did that mean he was here, in America?
Aliyah will brief you on Ansari, Hagen said. Jimmy will keep me in the loop via a secure connection. Dane's in charge of the mission.
Hagen leaned forward, his gaze serious.
This is dangerous, Cameron. Make no mistake, I'm only sending you along with these three because you know everything there is to know about your brother and where they might be keeping him. But you're to do everything they tell you and anything I tell you, Cameron. No arguments. Do you understand?
I nodded, glad to have people who actually knew what they were doing to tell me what to do.
I glanced at the gun in Dane's hand.
And what about Darius? I asked.
I've told Dane. Darius isn't to be harmed, if at all possible. We're operating under the assumption that he's innocent, and he's been working to help us stop Ansari.
And if he hasn't? I asked.
What then?
I was ashamed to doubt my brother, but it had to be said.
Then I'll deal with it, Dane said.
I shuddered. It didn't take much imagination to think what that might mean.
Trust each other, Hagen told us. Work as a team. Time is of the essence. We don't know how long we have before they strike. I'll do everything I can on my end to keep the authorities off your trail.
The van slowed.
We're here, Jimmy said.
Dane slid the van door open and hopped outside. After a quick look around, he nodded to Hagen. Hagen motioned for me to follow him. He led me around to the back of the van, where a mid-sized sedan with government plates was parked in a hidden spot off the road. It was cold out, way colder than anything I was used to in Arizona, and I buried my hands in my pockets and shivered. Hagen pulled a card from his jacket pocket and gave it to me. The only thing written on it was a phone number.
Memorize that, then throw it away, Hagen told me.
What is it? I asked.
A phone number of last resort, he told me. One last failsafe. You call that number from any payphone, any landline, any cell phone in the country, and the cavalry will come riding over the ridge to save you. And may I remind you to arrest you. Consider it a get-thrown-back-into-jail-free card, which would presumably be safer than the alternative. You call that number, and it's all over. Understand? Last chance saloon.
I nodded.
I'm putting you in harm's way, Cameron, which is a wicked thing for me to do to a lad of 17.
I started to protest, but Hagen held up a hand.
Spare me to I'm a man grown speech, he said. You're a senior in high school, and you've no business playing at cloak and dagger. But the simple fact is, I need you. Your country needs you, as the cliche goes.
My brother needs me, I said.
Aye, that he does, Hagen said. You're a good kid, Cameron, and an even better brother.
He held out his hand, and I shook it. Thanks, Mr. Hagen, for everything.
Call me Mickey, he said.
Dane came around the back of the van.
We need to do this, he said.
Hagen nodded and sent me back inside the van. He got into the sedan and pulled it out into the dark, lonely road across both lanes. Jimmy backed the van out and pulled it up to a stop in front of the car, as though Hagen had blocked our path.
What are you doing?
I asked Jimmy, but Aaliyah shook her head at me.
Ahead of us, Mickey Hagen got out of his car with a gun.
What's he doing? What's going on? I asked, but nobody answered me. Mickey came around the side of the van. Dane opened the sliding door, raised his gun, and shot Mickey Hagen in the leg.
No, I cried, lunging for the door. Mickey!
Dane held me back.
Go,
he told Jimmy. Jimmy floored it, and the van swerved off the road, around Mickey's car, and down the road.
What did you do that for? I cried.
Get down,
Dane said, and he pushed me to the floor. Bullets ripped into the van, punching holes in the metal doors on the back. The front windshield shattered but stayed in place.
Jeez, Mickey, Jimmy cried.
The van swerved, screeched, straightened. I heard more gunshots, but no more of them hit the van.
We're good, Jimmy said at last.
Dane helped me up off the floor.
It was Mickey's idea. To make it more convincing, he had nothing to do with your escape.
Mickey's idea? To let Dane shoot him in the leg? This was way more serious than I'd thought.
Get us to the backup van,
Dane told Jimmy, and he settled down on one of the benches to take his gun apart again. I crawled up on the bench across from him, staring at the bullet holes in the back of the van. Mickey had missed anything important on purpose, But the next time we ran into the authorities, the real authorities, we might not be so lucky. I was officially a wanted fugitive now, and this was officially real. Chapter 48. The motel room was empty when I came back in with a bucket full of ice. Jimmy was still in the bathroom, and Dane and Aaliyah hadn't come back from the van yet. We were in some little town in West Virginia, well off the main route anybody would take to Arizona. The CIA, the DHS, the FBI, they all knew by now that I thought Darius was in Arizona, so it only stood to reason that's where I'd be headed. Unless my abductors were taking me somewhere else. I still couldn't believe I'd sat there and watched Dane shoot Mickey Hagan. I'd seen people get shot before in movies and TV shows, but being there for the real thing was shocking. Guns were loud, made you jump. And to see the bullet rip into Mickey's leg, to know that it was real and not some special effect? I popped open one of the cans of soda Jimmy had brought with him and poured it over a plastic cup full of ice, trying not to think about Mickey. It felt like such a treat now, such an indulgence, to have a soda on ice after weeks of milk and juice from cartons. I sipped my drink and turned on the TV to distract myself. I shouldn't have. A photograph of me, my junior yearbook photo of all things, was on the first channel I went to. I winced. It had been weird to see Darius's picture all over the news, to hear famous announcers talking about him. It was even weirder to see my picture and hear people talking about me. Apparently, the secret of Cameron Smith was out. Nobody had known I was being held prisoner, but now they all knew I had escaped. The manhunt was on, Anderson Cooper said. Homegrown terrorist on the run, said Sean Hannity. Rachel Maddow called it a sad new chapter in an increasingly sad story. But the story was the same all over. Cameron Smith and his brother Darius Smith were American terrorists. One of the experts Hannity had on his show, some think tank guy I'd never heard of, said Darius and I had both wanted to join the army so we could take down America from within. They talked about my application to West Point, my time at East Phoenix High School, my run-ins with other kids. Was this really happening? They showed the front of my high school. Then Omar Maldonado, my old teammate, was on camera. He always acted all high and mighty, Omar said, like he was better than everybody else.
I knew he was a terrorist. It was just the way he looked at you, you know? Like he hated all of us, said Rachel Dubois, a junior girl I had literally never seen before in my entire life.
Nobody interviewed Adam or Julia or anybody else I'd thought had been my friends. But maybe they were saving that for the morning shows. Jimmy came out of the motel bathroom waving a Zippo lighter around.
Dude! Sorry about that. That's going to linger.
I clicked the TV off. I'd seen more than enough. Jimmy flipped his lighter closed and went straight for the ice, pouring a Red Bull for himself. Jimmy must have been only a few years older than me. He looked like somebody from a college garage band, with long, sandy blonde hair, multiple ear piercings, and expensive sneakers. The arms that stuck out from his black Arctic Monkeys Tour t-shirt were toned and tattooed. Black numbers ran up and down his left arm.
You like my ink? He said, catching me staring.
He pulled the sleeve of his t-shirt up to show me his whole arm. The numbers were big and small, stacked horizontally and vertically in all different kinds of fonts.
IP addresses, he told me. Every super secure site I've cracked is on here.
He pointed to different numbers as he said their names.
Pacific Bell, Microsoft, London Times, Bank of America, NASA.
You're a hacker, I said.
No, a cracker. Hackers just find the exploits. Crackers take advantage of them.
Jimmy grinned.
I'm what they call in the business a black hat. At least I used to be. Now I guess I'm a white hat, one of the good guys.
What happened? Why'd you change hats? Jimmy pointed to one of the largest numbers on his arm.
This one right here. United States Department of Defense. That's right, the Pentagon. I was just going in to punk them, honest. I was going to replace the DOD website with one that looked like the game choices Matthew Broderick gets when he dials in war games. You know, chess, poker, tic-tac-toe, global thermonuclear war.
I shrugged and shook my head. I had no idea what he was talking about.
Jimmy threw up his arms.
Nobody watches the classics anymore. Anyway, they caught me. Stupid, really. I should have bounced the signal through a few more onion layers of symmetric encryption. Got cocky, got caught. So I cut a deal. I'd tell them how I got in and how to fix it, and they wouldn't throw me in jail for the rest of my life. Open up a whole new career for me. Now all kinds of companies pay me to test out their internet security.
He pretended to take off a hat and put another on.
Black hat off, white hat on. I never made so much money. I've even done work for the CIA. That's how I met Mickey. Of course, the DOD still makes me wear a GPS ankle monitor.
Jimmy hiked up his pants leg to show me a black gizmo strapped to his ankle.
You're wearing a GPS monitor? I said.
But that means they can track you, track us.
Chill, dude, Jimmy said. I cracked this thing the day they put it on me. As far as the good old US of A knows, I'm at a video game convention in Orlando.
Dane and Aaliyah came back with armloads of bags and equipment, and I hurried to take one of them from Aaliyah. She smiled at my zealous chivalry like she was on to me, but still appreciative. She had changed clothes from before, trading in her business suit for jeans and a t-shirt that read Backstreet Boys and showed a printed photo of the band.
What happened? I asked, nodding at her t-shirt. Did you have to go shopping at the Goodwill?
Aaliyah's bright smile suddenly switched off, and she gave me an icy stare. I knew immediately that I'd made a mistake, and my heart sank. Jimmy hooted.
Ooh-hoo, you've done it now, kid. Nobody makes fun of the boys around the princess and lives.
I'm sorry, I said, my face hot with embarrassment. I didn't mean.
You only get one warning, Aaliyah said, perfectly serious. And I'm not a princess, she told Jimmy.
You checked the room for bugs?
Dane asked.
Yeah, yeah, Jimmy said. Gave the place the sweep. We're clean.
Aaliyah latched the door and flipped the security lock.
Are we all sleeping in the same room? I asked. I mean, is Aaliyah?
Yes, Dane said. It's more secure.
Jimmy grinned.
You were thinking maybe you two could share a room, cowboy?
My face must have been as red as Jimmy's soda can. No, I didn't mean...
Just ignore him, Aaliyah said.
She set up a laptop on the little table by the window and pulled out a chair.
Now have a seat, Cameron. It's time you learned all about Haidar Ansari.
Chapter 49
Haidar Ansari, Aaliyah said, a.k.a. the Lion.
Aaliyah called up a picture of a boy playing soccer. There were other players in the foreground, and the picture was kind of blurry, but the shot was clear enough to see that Ansari was a good-looking guy with olive skin and dark, curly hair.
He's just a teenager, I said.
Was. He's in his 40s now. But this is the only confirmed picture we have of him, Aaliyah said. I stared at the picture. It could have been me playing soccer instead of football. We didn't resemble each other all that much, but for at least one brief, innocent moment, both our lives had been about nothing more than scoring a goal or a touchdown, not politics.
Haidar Ansari was born into a well-to-do family from Tikrit, Iraq, the same city where Saddam Hussein was raised, Aaliyah explained. Ansari's distantly related to Hussein, in fact, third cousin, three times removed.
Fathers, brothers, nephews, cousins, former roommate? Jimmy joked.
He hopped on one of the beds with his laptop and groaned.
Ow! Who picked this motel? These mattresses are like stone.
Dane thumped a heavy canvas duffel bag on the other bed.
I've slept on stone before, he said. This is better.
Aaliyah ignored them.
Ansari's family was rewarded with power and wealth when Hussein took power. Wealth and power they lost when Baghdad fell and Saddam was defeated during Operation Desert Storm.
You were in that one, weren't you, Dane?
Jimmy asked.
Dane didn't look up from the bag he was rooting through.
I was in that one, he said.
As a part of the ruling Ba'ath Party, Ansari's family lost everything in the war. To escape persecution from the new Shia government, they fled to Syria, where Ansari spent the rest of his youth angry at the United States for ruining his life. It wasn't long, of course, before he fell in with Al-Qaeda.
As you do, Jimmy said.
As you do, Aaliyah said. Ansari went on to make a new name for himself, going to university and becoming a successful businessman in his own right. We now know he was funneling much of that money back into Al-Qaeda. When Osama bin Laden was killed in 2011, Al-Qaeda effectively splintered into dozens of smaller autonomous cells around the world, which was how it was designed to operate in the first place. Soon after, Haidar Ansari went from merely funding militant activities to leading them, becoming the leader of a particularly dangerous cell in Afghanistan. My eyes went from the picture of the young Haidar Ansari to the file on him on Aaliyah's screen. The beginning read like the bio of any regular guy. Born, went to school, married a Syrian woman named Bashira, had kids, a home, a career. But in 2011, he'd given it all up. Left it all behind to become a black-masked face in an Al-Qaeda video, leading terrorist attacks from a hidden bunker somewhere inside Afghanistan. Ansari's cell has been responsible for some of the worst attacks on U.S. servicemen and civilians in years, Aaliyah said. We know it's him, but we still haven't been able to catch him. She called up a picture of a bombed-out building in a dusty desert town. We thought we'd killed him with a drone strike 3 years ago. But 6 months later, he claimed responsibility for a bombing in Egypt that killed 6 Americans. He's like a cockroach. We step on him, but he just comes back.
Just like Lindsay Lohan, Jimmy said.
We don't know where he is, but we do know that he's alive, Aaliyah said. If you and Mickey are right, and he is in America,
Aaliyah shook her head.
If he is here, why? What's his target?
Dane asked.
Ansari's trademarks are intricate plots and false clues. It's all about misdirection, Aaliyah said. Which is why I agree with Mickey. He meant for us to uncover the Women's World Cup plot. He wants us to think we're safe. That's when he'll strike. And it'll be big, whatever it is. He wants an audience. He wants to scare as many people as possible.
And if he is in America, he'll want to do it soon, before he's discovered, Dane said.
Here's something that might help, Jimmy said.
He turned his computer around.
Mickey just sent us your brother's latest music video.
Chapter 50.
Another video from Darius?
We all gathered around Jimmy's computer. Darius read another prepared statement off a piece of paper. He looked older, more tired. His beard was long now. I almost didn't recognize him. There was almost nothing of the old Darius I knew and loved there on the screen.
Is this how Haidar Ansari's wife and children felt as they watched him transform into a terrorist? Watched him become someone they didn't know anymore? I tried to focus on what Darius was saying. It was the usual death to America stuff. And then Darius dropped 2 Rostam clues. The first was Rostam versus Godzilla, a story we'd made up after watching a bunch of Japanese monster movies on cable one afternoon. The other was a bit about the Joker's goons again. I sat back on the rock-hard bed, deflated.
What? Jimmy asked. What is it?
It's the same code he used before, I said. The one about football. But the other clue is new, isn't it? Aaliyah said. About Godzilla?
Yeah. Rostam and Siavash have to fight Godzilla,
We couldn't beat him, so we lured him into a rocket ship full of hot dogs and blasted him into space. Jimmy snickered. We were little kids, I argued for what felt like the millionth time. What I want to know is why Darius is still talking about the Women's World Cup.
To make sure you got it, Dane said.
But we took care of it already, I said. The CIA, the army, whoever, they stopped it.
Maybe they haven't heard, Jimmy said. Maybe they've got their heads buried too far in the sand.
No,
Aaliyah said. I refuse to believe Ansari doesn't know. Even if their contacts didn't tell him, it was all over the news, in every newspaper in the world. It was even on ESPN. Haidar Ansari knows. His World Cup bomb plot was foiled. But I think he wanted it to be.
Plans within plans?
Dane asked.
Precisely, Aaliyah said.
Give the CIA a bomb plot in Canada to throw us off the scent of what he's really up to here in America. Something he's kept so secret, not even Darius knows about it. Unless there's a clue to it in your Godzilla story.
Ansari's going to fire a rocket full of hot dogs at us,